continued to do another record, and we just locked ourselves in a room and kind of came up with it. Most of the lyrics were inspired by the normal stuff I write about, which is, you know, drugs and alcohol, recovery thereof. I write from a perspective concerning those subjects that's ambiguous, so that, you know, somebody who's recovering from crack addiction will dig the tune, as well as the guy who's smoking crack at the time will also dig the tune, you know. So I try to write it from that kind of a perspective. And the rest of the record is my other normal subjects, which are, you know, the God and the devil and the balance between, the balance between good and evil, or the indifference thereof.
Now, in the past, you've done most of the writing yourself, correct?
Uh-huh.
What did you intentionally want to bring more of the band into this time around?
Yeah, I think that I've always wanted to, and it's just a matter of, you know, having the guys actually motivated to do it.
They're lazy?
Yeah. Sean and I have written together quite a bit in the past. I'd say Sean wrote at least 40% of Rocket Number 9 of the last record.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but on this one we had the bass player writing and our old drummer writing.
Was that challenging for you? Was it edifying? How did it work well? Was it a struggle?
Yeah, no, not at all. I get along real well with those guys. I mean, I live with them, you know, 300 days a year on the road. So, you know, writing together wasn't hard at all, and you know, it was easy for me. I think the reason primarily that it happened was that way was we've all been so busy playing that, you know, we had all written things individually on our own, so when we got together, just putting it all together collectively, like somebody had a bass line, somebody had a guitar part, and somebody had some lyrics, and just putting them all together, and everything just seemed to fit well together, and so we got real lucky like that.
What did they bring to the songs that maybe wouldn't have happened without them?
Well, certainly harmonic sophistication. You know, that, you know, I can play a little guitar enough to figure out roughly what kind of chords I want behind me, but, you know, the chords that Sean's putting over the same tunes that I write are not anything like the ones that I would have picked.
Mm-hmm.
And because I just don't have the frame of reference to imagine what kind of chords could be there. So there's that, there's arrangements, there's changes and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, Todd is my bass player, Todd Edmonds, Buckwheat. He's a, you know, he's a classically trained musician. And so he can sight read and he can break down in his head in a matter of less than seconds by ear all the notes that are in any given chord he hears.
Mm-hmm.
So he can really think through a lot more jazzy kind of arrangements a lot quicker. So having his intellect involved in, you know, helping Sean even pick the chords is just brilliant. You know, so that's making things change quite a bit. You know, I just have a general consensus of what I want to do lyrically, and as far as the changes go, I might say, you know, okay, I want it to be a 1-1-5-6-2-5. Okay, and but I didn't say what kind of one chord I want, whether it's a ninth chord or a flat seven or whatever. Yeah.
See,
good. Hold on 1 second.
Sure.
Hold on 1 second. All right, great. Thanks.
You mentioned addiction before. What's your history with addiction?
Yeah,
or do you have a history with addiction?
No, I sure do. I'm 11. I'm 11 years sober. Hold on 1 second. Yeah, 33. Okay, sorry, we just got off the road here, and I'm getting my house in order here. I have a. I've been a sober 11 years. I did a year in jail over that. I've worked in the field of recovery. You know, as a clinician in a detox place. So, you know, I've been around it my whole life. My father was an alcoholic. My grandfather's on both sides. Grandmother's on both sides. Alcoholics, addicts, you know, drug addicts, so the whole thing. So, you know, it's been a big part of my life and still is, even though I'm no longer, you know, actively using. I am still, you know, once an addict, always an addict. And I do believe, I don't believe that I'm in recovery. I believe I'm recovered from drugs and alcohol. That, you know, that, so I'm not, I don't feel weak or anything like that. I don't have urges to use, you know, like, one might think somebody would, you know, certainly not after 11 years, maybe the first couple years I did, but, you know, but it's still a subject that intrigues me very much.
Mm-hmm. What were your substances?
Crack cocaine, alcohol, barbiturates, you know, benzodiazepine of any form, Klonopin, Librium, the whole thing. Yeah, Xanax, Valium.
Is it still obviously it still provides material for you? Are there you have things to say about it, things to work out still in your songs?
Because on the new CD I wrote Life of Denial. So that, you know, that's not a song really so much about me as it is about, you know, other people that are now doing the same kind of things to me that I did to other people. You know what I mean? So, you know, it's a song about addiction, but, you know, it's more or less from the standpoint of somebody, you know, who's hurt by somebody else that's in the throes of addiction. Whereas in the past, you know, I wrote songs like, you know, if anybody had ever hurt me the way I hurt myself, you know, they'd be buried underground beyond the good Lord's help. You know, that was one of the tunes I wrote on the last CD, or The Rocker, which is, you know, a tune about crack. So, you know, those are the kind of tunes that I was still working stuff out, you know. And a lot of those tunes, you know, I wrote while I was in jail, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I had a lot of time to kind of figure things out. So, you know, a lot of them I wrote and they were good, so I just put them in a notebook and kept them until I found the right players to suss it all out with.
When were you in jail?
What was it, 98 to 99.
So
year and a day.
So was that what cleaned you up, or what started the process?
Totally, man. You know, I tried rehab and stuff like that, and it didn't work for me, man. You know, I got a smart mouth and a sharp mind, and I like to argue way too much, and I'm way too manipulative for most programs, and I was in a real tough kind of program. You know, like one of those boot camp kind of programs where they make you dig graves with spoons, and, you know, kids had hung themselves and shit in there. You know what I mean? So it was one of these places that, you know, someday somebody will make a movie about it, you know. And I was in a place like that, and it didn't work. So, you know, I needed the threat of permanent incarceration. See, that's exactly what happened. I was up for a serious felony charge, a strong-arm robbery. And the judge told me I could go, you know, I could go do 5 years in prison, okay, in prison, or I could enter into a program where I do a year in jail and 4 years of drug offender probation. Now, this is down in Florida, you know, West Palm Beach County. And so I chose that, and then from there, I was able to move myself into another boot camp type of program, except state-run. Now, the condition upon that program there was that should I screw up in that program, and it doesn't take anything to screw up in there, like trading food, using cigarettes as currency, leaning against a wall, folding your arms, those kind of things. You get six times to screw up. Should I screw up in that program within a year and a day's time, 366 days, I go back and serve my full sentence of 5 years in prison. Now, that 5 years in prison is a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd have to go back before the judge with another charge. Okay? So there's a good chance that I could have done much more time than that. So anyway, I was in a situation where it was very wise for me, and even me, as hard-headed as I am, it was very wise for me to keep my mouth shut and listen. And during that process, I was able to suspend my ego for long enough to get temporarily brainwashed so that I was able to actually listen to what some of the people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous had to say, and that's what got me sober, man.
What was your relationship to music when you were actively using it in those early stages of recovery, were you still performing, writing? Were you doing anything at that point?
Yeah, I made it through most of it. You know, the last year in 98 before I was incarcerated, it was starting to get to the point where I could no longer perform. Now, I don't mean, you know, actually get on stage and perform, but what I mean is nobody wanted to hire me, man. You know what I mean? Because it wasn't, you know, and I was very grandiose at the time. I thought it was because, you know, people were afraid I was going to blow them off the stage, you know. But the real reason was something very, much more mundane, like I just smelled really bad. You know what I mean? Things like that.
Yeah.
You know?
How did you get back into it? Obviously, you had some baggage.
Yeah. Well, I had a few years where I couldn't work legally in bars. That was a condition of drug offender probation. So it wasn't quite a few years. It was about a year and a half or 2 years. And during that time, I just waited tables and worked at a record store. And then after that, I started working with a local band down in Florida called the Knucklebusters, which was a very popular local blues band in South Florida. And they had a lot of work, man. So, you know, I was able to more or less hone a new style of playing harmonica. And during that time, so it was, you know, the whole thing was just an incredible gift. You know, the time in jail, the time thinking, the time reading, the time reevaluating my spirituality, reevaluating what I was going to do when I got out, writing, changing the way I played, changing the way I thought about music, garnering a tremendous amount of influence from jazz music and from other forms of music, East Indian, and other kinds of styles like that. I was really able to immerse myself away from just the blues, you know, and the reason being was that was not available to me. I didn't have a CD player, okay? I had to listen to whatever was on the radio,
mm-hmm.
and the only stuff that was on the radio, now this wasn't while I was in the program because I wasn't allowed to listen to music. I wasn't allowed to play music for a whole year. But when I got out, I entered into a work release program, and I was given a stereo, or I bought a stereo eventually, but I only had a radio. And so I would listen to this show that came on called China Valles. He was on the air for 50 years. He knew Charlie Parker. He was buddies with Coltrane, this DJ. He'd been on the air for 50 years. He's not there now. He was replaced with talk radio after 50-some-odd years. But anyway, he had a jazz show that was on from midnight till 6 in the morning. And so, man, I got turned on to, like, Ben Webster and Coltrane and Pharoah Sanders and all of that stuff, you know, that, you know, I'd been interested in jazz. I was into Miles, some of the Miles stuff, especially the real, you know, LSD-influenced jazz, you know, Roland Kirk and Arthur Blythe and James Blood Ulmer and some of the Miles stuff, like On the Corner and Bitches Brew and, you know, Pharoah, of course, and some of the 60s Coltrane stuff. I had been hip to that, but I hadn't really cut my teeth on bebop or pre-bebop or hard bop. Okay, so that was all new to me. And just guys, you know, even guys like Ben Webster and Lester Young and people like that, I hadn't delved into that. I hadn't listened to that music yet. I mean, there was a whole Ellington songbook that I wasn't, for the most part, really familiar with. You know, there are a couple of tunes that blues guys had covered, you know, Don't Get Around Much Anymore and, you know, Things Ain't the Way They Used to Be. You know, I knew, you know, some of those kind of tunes, but, you know, the whole Ellington and Basie, Mingus thing, all that was new to me. So it's just like a whole world of just music, just, you know, in a six-hour radio show every night for a few months, you know. I started getting out and I started playing this music. You know, or you know, allowing it to influence, maybe not playing it, but allowing it to influence what I was doing.
And how'd you get hooked up with Big Al then? Was that?
I moved up. Yeah, you're great. First of all, I moved up to. This is one of the better interviews I've had in a long time. I moved up mainly because I get to talk all the time. So I moved up to Raleigh, North Carolina. Was working at a place called the Healing Place, where I was a clinician in detox. You know, helping people going through DTs and shit like that. And I was just more or less a night watchman. And I'd take intakes and stuff like that. I spoke a little Spanish so I could help out with some of those guys. And so anyway, they'd come in and stuff. And I was practicing all the time. And I got a call from Big Al. And I was pretty close to giving up music at that period in my life because I really liked that job. and I was real close to earning. I was accredited addictions professional, but not certified, meaning I had done enough hours in the field, and all I had to do was pass the test, take the test and pass it. And I could have passed the test before I went into recovery, just because, you know, you find a pill on the floor, ask me, I'll tell you what it is. So, you know, Big Al called me and asked me if I wanted to play on the road. And, you know, man, it didn't take me 2 minutes to decide. As much as I was ready to quit music, as soon as I got a call to go back, to go really on the road, because I'd only ever played regionally. And when I was with Junior Kimbrough and R.L. Burnside, you know, I only ever played in Mississippi with those guys. Because those guys weren't popular, man, like they are now.
Right.
When I was with them, you know. Because, you know, R.L. hadn't cut the record with John Spencer yet. And Junior Kimbrough hadn't died. So nobody cared about either of them. So they never really tour. They do one tour a year at the House of Blueses, and back then there were only four of them. I was 95. So when Al called me, I was game. I just went on the road with him, just really paid attention to how he ran the band, because he booked the band, managed the band, produced his own records, and drove the van. And so I was like, well, you know, man, this is doable. As just like a businessman, like as a private contractor, you know, more than a band leader, I paid attention to how is it done. You know, how do you do it? Because here's the situation. You know, if I can make it through this band, which I did, you know, if I could do enough time to learn the skills, I could start my own group. And then I could never be fired. I can play my own music. I can pick whatever I want. And I loved working with Al, and he was a great guy and stuff. But I wasn't crazy about, you know, songs every single night that all they had to do with was Crawfish and Gumbo and all of that stuff. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. Man, people loved that music. You know, it was fun. It was a good party band. It's a party band. You know, but I'm not a party kind of guy. You know what I mean? I'm way more into writing about, you know, the devil than I am into writing about fucking Crawfish.
So you hooked up with him in, it was about 2000?
Yeah.
And then you left after, what, about 15 months?
Year exactly. Now?
And that's when you started New Blood?
Yeah.
And what were you playing initially? Did you have a lot of songs to play? Were you doing a lot of covers at that point?
Yeah, you know, I was doing covers and my own original blues 1-4-5 material, because I was trying to find musicians to come out on the road with me. So, you know, I was going out with a different band, you know, every couple of months, you know, until I could find a core group of individuals. Because before, I didn't have a lot of work, you know, and the tours didn't pay a lot. So I was having to get whoever I could get. I couldn't pick and choose the musicians that I wanted to stay permanently. But eventually what I did was I rented a house, and with enough bedrooms in it that I could put up the guys I wanted to, they could live there for free. I couldn't barely pay them $350 a week in salary, but they were living for free.
Mm-hmm.
And then I imported them into Nashville from Florida, mostly, and I had a bass player from Memphis. So that went on for a little while until I settled on the core of the group, which is, you know, Todd Edmonds, the bass player, and Sean Starsky. And then we've had numerous problems with drummers. As a matter of fact, I have a new drummer moving into my house for a month or so until he can find an apartment today.
Yeah, Spinal Tap problem, right?
Man, we're like Spinal Tap with these guys. Except they don't die.
Would it be better if they did?
I'm kidding. Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about how the covers on this record, why you chose them, and how you felt they fit in stylistically, thematically? I don't think you're going to find another record that has Misfits, Sun Ra, and Willie Dixon on it.
Yeah, maybe not. Well, I've always, I've never tried to make anything fit in. Okay, I'm a firm believer that if you play what you love, and if you do, and if you've done your homework with the material, that you'll get it done right. And people, that the enthusiasm of the piece, as long as there has been an appropriate amount of homework done, will translate to people. Okay. Now there are certain people that I believe listen much more with their minds than with their ears. and I think they're they're all too willing to note that there's misfits Willie Dixon and Sun Ra, and those things don't go together. Okay. However, I have a feeling if you put Willie Dixon, Sun Ra, and Glenn Danzig in a room together, they'd have quite a bit to talk about. And there would be very little, there'd be less difference between the two of them than there would be, or three of them, between, than there would be similarities. Mm-hmm. I feel the same way about music. I don't understand why nowadays music has to be categorized as much as it is. In the 60s, you had bands like Janis Joplin, The Doors, Jimi Hendrix, The Byrds. All of these bands incorporated Eastern music, country music, blues music, rock and roll music, jazz influences, all within one record. And nobody cared. Nobody said, I'm going to see a blues band tonight. Nobody said, I'm going to see a rock band tonight. Maybe it fell under the heading of rock and roll, which is fine with me. Okay, but nobody said that. They said, I'm going to see Janis tonight. I'm going to see Jimi Hendrix. And they were just bands. You know, War. Look at that band. I mean, every imaginable influence is in that music. And nobody had a problem with that. Sun Ra himself recorded doo-wop, straight-ahead jazz, did whole records of nothing but Disney covers, of music from Disney. You know, I mean, here's a guy without limits. We don't have any grand mission statement to change the blues or to change music. We're just playing the stuff that we hear, that we dig, as far as cover tunes. We heard I Turned Into a Martian, and, you know, I've been a fan of the Misfits since I was a little tiny kid. And, you know, like, you know, 11 or 12 years old when I got my first Misfits record. And, you know, we heard it, and we're listening to it one day in the van, and I'm like, you know, this is a Texas Shuffle. This isn't nothing but the hip shake on steroids. I was like, let's just do it. Let's give it a try and see what happens. It's fun. It's a great song. And it's a song about demonic possession, which is a subject I relate to and have had some experience with directly. And so I dug the tune. And the other, you know, the title track of the record, Done With the Devil, is another song about demonic possession. So I felt the two subjects went together lyrically. And they were similar points of view on the subject, and although one's a little funnier than the other, I Turned Into a Martian is a funny line of a song, you know. And then Enlightenment, Sun Ra tune, man, you know, that tune is just absolutely gorgeous. I'm not talking about our version of it, I'm talking about Ra's. And you know, I'm not going to comment on our version of it, although I like it, but I'm not, but musically, whatever. But Ra's different takes on that song are just intoxicating. And it's a magical, magical piece of music. And there's just so many of his tunes that are just absolutely magical. And then the Willie Dixon thing, man, we had a request from the label, man, to do one little Walter song. So I picked the one I liked the best, you know.
Now the Enlightenment sounds a little like could be on a Tom Waits record almost.
I've gotten that off of Broken Toy too. People have said that about that song as well.
Yeah, and I actually had written down. I actually had those in the same line because it does kind of have the kind of phrasing that Waits might give to it.
Right.
Was that is Tom Waits?
No. It's not. I mean, I'm a huge Tom Waits fan, but it wasn't. I mean, I wrote those lyrics because I had to, you know, and then I sang them the only way I know how, and I'm not a very good vocalist. I'm a good entertainer live, and I can take whatever I'm singing about and make the audience feel it, okay? Now, whether I make them feel it on key or with a 3-octave range is seriously in question, okay? But I can look people dead in the eyes and sing a lyric, and they know that my life depends upon singing that lyric. Okay, there's no question of that. So in that element, you know, that's how I came up with that. I think the Waits influence comes from the fact that he's incorporated polka and sort of mysterious carnival-esque type sounding music prior to us, of course. And that genre and those influences have not been as pronounced within other artists in the last 20 years as Tom Waits. So naturally, the mind references his material. Although Boyd and King Crimson and the Beatles and another of other bands have incorporated those exact same vibes and feels, and that's probably where Tom Waits got some of it from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. However, we reference Waits because my voice is rough. It's not easy. I'm not a great singer. He is not a great singer in terms of, you know, technical merit. And, you know, he's a great singer in terms of he reaches people and he communicates the message of his tune, but he's not Ella Fitzgerald or Betty Carter. You know what I mean? Or Pavarotti. You know, he's got what he does, and he does it extremely, extremely well. Much better than I do. But, you know, neither one of us can sing. You know, I don't know. I hope he doesn't read that in Davenport. You know, he might be there next week.
You know, I do not think he would dispute that he can't sing.
Good.
In Broken Toy, you sing Too Straight for the Faggots, Too Queer for the Girls. Do you feel comfortable, and I know obviously politically and with your sexuality, you have some issues with some of your audiences, some audiences have issues with you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel kind of naked being that personal with these lyrics?
No, I feel empowered by it. The lyrics are empowering. When I sing that song, that's my time to give the audience the middle finger, and usually they give me a big hug backwards, you know, and in some way or another. I've always been about nudity on stage, you know, both literal and figurative, and you know, the greatest performer I've ever seen, I never saw in real life, but it is Janis Joplin. And I am frequently on the verge of emotional breakdown on stage. I'm frequently on the verge of losing it. It's often difficult for me to sing lyrics well because I'm crying during some of them or laughing. And so for me, the being a frontman has been all about stripping the layers of the onion away and taking away the mask. So many white blues performers put on a persona when they climb on stage, and they try to qualify with a suit or a haircut or some kind of affected speech pattern. Okay, that's going to let people know that they're the real blues. They might be white, but they're the real blues. For me, it's been the opposite. In order to be the real blues, for me, whatever the hell that means, okay, but for me, it's been about sincerity. And to me, nobody ever embodied that the way, you know, somebody like Janis Joplin did. And so it's, for me, it's been like when I look at Janis, it's not like I want to be like Janis, but what I do is, what I see is a person up there who's letting it go and who's taken away the mask and has let herself appear as she is to the audience. That's the same thing that I'm trying to do when I get up on stage. It doesn't always happen, and I'm not always capable of delivering that. And not every audience wants that or is ready for that. And when they don't want it and they're not ready for it, they don't get it. Because cast not ye pearls unto swine, lest they be trampled underfoot.
So you have to gauge an audience to determine whether you're going to do a political song or Broken Toy, for example, and kind of see how receptive they are?
Yeah.
And I know you've said in some other interviews that in the United States, at least, you don't play a lot of political songs because
no.
They're not receptive.
Nope.
Still true?
I can't even do Get Up Stand Up. You know, a Bob Marley cover.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the line about we're sick and tired of your bullshit games, dying go to heaven in Jesus' name. That's going to get me into a fight. Okay, these are songs that were played on the radio in the 70s. Okay, or in the 60s, Gil Scott Heron. I can't cover Gil Scott's music, the military and the monetary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't cover these tunes. You know what I mean? This is not acceptable anymore. Nobody spends money on those kind of songs to be on the radio. So the conditioning of Joe Public is zero. You know what I mean? What makes it on the radio is, you know, Oops, I Did It Again, and these great little pop ditties. And they are great, and I have nothing against Britney Spears, man. I'm all for the girl, man. You know, but the thing is that you can't have tunes, you can't have Sympathy for the Devil on the radio anymore. You know what I mean? You're not going to sell records. Nobody's going to put thousands of or millions of dollars behind songs that have any kind of message whatsoever, especially if not 100% of the public can agree with it.
So why tour here? I don't mean that entirely rhetorically, but I know that you've talked sometimes about Europe being a more receptive environment.
So what do you mean? What do you mean? Why tour what?
Why tour the United States? I mean, you talked for earlier about not wanting to be in a party band, and...
Yeah. Because I have to, man. Because I have to. Well, first of all, it's my mission to do whatever I'm going to do. You know, it's my will in life to do my own music, and this is my country too, man. And, you know, I don't care if not everybody gets it. I'm not out here to make $1 million. I'm not trying to sell as many records as Britney. If I do, I'll be stoked. I'd love to have the money.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, I'd rather have my integrity intact than the money. Given a choice, you know, if I have to pick one, I can't have both. I'll do that. As far as Europe goes, man, I'm trying. I'm trying to get over there.
Mm-hmm.
As far as different venues, jam bands and venues like that, where this music would not be a big deal, hell yeah, I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying. The problem is, you know, my name isn't out there enough. You know, I've been working the blues circuit so long, man, that's the only place where people know me.
And I
try to go to a jam band room, and they want to give me the door. They don't want to give me a guarantee. Well, I got guys on salary, man.
Mm-hmm.
I can't risk that.
Do you feel stuck in the blues circuit, then?
No. I mean, I'm certainly comfortable there, man. You know, do I feel that I made some errors marketing myself initially? Maybe. Okay, do I feel that I qualify well enough to be in the blues circuit as the chronological history of African-American music presents itself? Yeah, sure. I think I fit in good enough. You know, some of these other people don't, and that's their opinion, and they're certainly welcome to it. And they would make some very excellent points against me. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But this music has never been classical. It's never been written down. And the black performers that created this music were always changing it. And that's why we listen to them. And so I fit into the spirit of the music, if not the form, you know. But no, I don't feel trapped here. I love our fans, and I love blues fans and stuff for the most part. You know, there's some of them that, you know, obviously don't like me because I'm queer and because I got a big mouth and because I wear punk rock clothes, because I like the way they look on me, because I look hot and sexy. And that's the only reason I wear them. Hold on, I got to plug my phone in for it. I'm out of batteries.
Okay.
Okay.
You mentioned demonic possession a couple times. You mean that literally?
I'm sorry, rephrase the question. I was reaching for a cigarette.
You mentioned demonic possession a couple times, and you said you had some experience with that. Do you mean that literally or figuratively?
I mean it literally.
So you believe in demonic possession?
I believe in demons. I believe in angels. And I believe in anything that people have believed in enough to impregnate it with the energy it needs to be capable of existing. Okay? I believe that the psychological and spiritual mind overlap, and we are capable of willing into existence entities, elementals, and gods, demons, angels, whatever, Bigfoot, you know, you name it, ghosts, whatever. I believe that the that perception is key, that reality is subjective, and that those two things can become one and the same.
Do you mean, and I'm just interested in this, I'm just interested in the idea. Do you mean that Bigfoot exists because we have willed, Bigfoot literally exists because we have willed Bigfoot into existence, or Bigfoot exists because enough people believe in Bigfoot that it's there?
Do you understand? I'm not taking a stance on the issue other than that I'm saying it's possible that we can will Bigfoot into existence.
Literally.
Yes, literally.
Okay. Do you believe that, was your addiction related to your belief in demons? Do you believe that your addiction,
no,
drug problems, that so you're talking about two completely separate things there?
No, I think that was genetic. Okay. Yeah, I might have played a part in it. My addiction was also created by my need to romance great musicians and their association with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that should I experiment with drugs, that I would be closer to my heroes. Okay? And the result was that eventually I became actually physically and mentally addicted to the drugs. So it was no longer very romantic anymore at that point when I was turning tricks to get another hit. Okay. Yeah.
When you're talking,
but it started off like, wow, Jim Morrison's so cool. I'm going to do coke too.
So when you mentioned experience with demonic possession, you when you're talking about that, you're not saying that you're not, it's a separate incident or incidents?
Yeah, it's a separate incident. Mm-hmm. It's very theistic too. I'm very theistic about it. Okay, I believe, like I said earlier, that psychologically, okay, it's very possible. Okay, that this was an experience that I had on my own. But I theistically and literally believe that a demon came and possessed me. What evidence do I have of that? The evidence I have of that, whether it existed in my mind prior, in my subconscious, okay, prior to that, is that I am routinely given messages in dream state, okay, through, and sometimes otherwise, through entities which I cannot assign a name better than demons, okay? Meaning the Greek translation of the word demon is daemon, D-A-E-M-O-N, and means brilliant spirit, okay? Christianity has assigned and blackened the name with a completely different subject, okay? The entities that I communicate with are neither positive or negative. They are apathetic. They feed off of fear. They thrive off of fear. The less I fear them, the more intrigued I am by them, the less they appear. Okay? They thrive off of that. They communicate messages to me that I can look up in the morning on Google and validate.
So this is something that continues.
Yeah, it was a problem until I started researching it, and now it's under control. Perhaps too much. And now I'm working on actual evocation and invocation techniques to bring them back.
So when you say you can validate them on Google, could you give me an example of something that you had in one of these states that you
sure
couldn't have known otherwise, and you found out?
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Well, the first demon to ever appear to me came in the form of a snake. And he spoke to me about the nature of nature and how man is reflective of that. Okay, and how the true nature of man and the nature of mankind. And what our mission here is. And that message was very shocking and very Darwinian in like a survival of the fittest kind of way. Okay, the creature or entity or whatever you want to call it, it evaded telling me its name for a very, very long time until eventually it spoke to me and told me its name. Its name was APEP, A-P-E-P. I looked up APAT the next morning and found that he was a snake, and he was an ancient Egyptian snake, and was a god that tried to swallow the moon. And I found out a bunch of other mythology, which I don't know how well APAT relates with that mythology or not. I haven't seen him in a while. I'm laughing because it just sounds so ridiculous. But I've never done an interview like this before, just so you know. This is the first time. Yeah, you're the first to get it. So, So anyway, there's one. APEP really exists. That was the name I was given. I typed it into a Google search. I didn't misspell it. I didn't do anything. There it was. My first demonic, I'll give you another one. My first demonic possession experience was preceded by three knocks on a door at 3 a.m. in the morning. Prior to me experiencing demonic possession, I experienced powers of clairvoyance, telepathy, and telekinesis, and pyrokinesis. Okay, I looked that up the next day, found a Christian website that listed signs of demonic possession being clairvoyance, telekinesis, pyrokinesis, telepathy, preceded by three knocks at a door frequently, often at 3 in the morning, the symbolism of three being a mocking of the Holy Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you were able to move things?
No, in a dream.
Okay, in a dream. Okay.
Yeah.
So the do these things make their ways? Obviously, you talked about songs about demonic possession. These things provide ideas, sources for songs?
Yeah, more now than ever. Done with the Devil was just the start of it. Wait till the next record. It was during Done with the Devil that I switched from Buddhism to becoming an occultist. And it was during the recording and making of Done with the Devil where I was tortured nightly by demonic forces and actual paranormal experiences that didn't take place in a dream, and things moving around and noises and visitations and voices and all of these things. And I'm not crazy, man. I'm not schizophrenic. Okay. These types of things took place. They were witnessed by other people. And I don't care if anybody believes it or not. You know, this is what happened. I made a decision one day to not be scared anymore. The decision was reinforced and supplied with tools that came from the occult world. Because here's a world that chooses not to fear these things, that chooses to deal with them, use them, incorporate them, empower them, and control them. Okay? So I became an avid Crowley fanatic. Okay, is what happened. And it was through the magical systems of the Golden Dawn and other orders and people influenced by those orders that I was given the tools necessary to become a competent enough human being as to make it through life without feeling like I couldn't go to bed in a dark room anymore.
And you mentioned the next record and how this was going to manifest itself in that. Is that record in process?
Yeah, I'm a little intimidated by the idea of it. I want to make sure that I write really, really well about these subjects. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't started any songs yet. I mean, Broken Toy, as much as it's about being an outsider and about very literal things like not being too rich and not being too poor, it's also a subject about being in the middle. And as is above, so is below. And neither good nor evil. And neither animal nor human. Okay, and these are very occult-esque ideas. So I've already been writing from this subject. I've already been writing from this genre before I was even aware of it. So I have to try to continue to write. And Broken Toy for me was very close to Class A text, meaning that it was very close to something that came through me. It wasn't literally Class A text. It wasn't channeled or automatic writing. However, it was very close to that. If I'm going to produce lyrics that are sufficient enough to describe some of my belief pattern here, I'm going to have to try to tap into at least the same level that I did with Broken Toy. And I don't know how I'm going to do that yet, man, but I'm going to try. You know, maybe I'll set up a ritual to songwrite. Yeah.
You mentioned Danzig. You take these things seriously, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't take Glenn Danzig seriously, and I don't know if he does takes, you know, kind of the takes the subject matter seriously or not, but would you be worried at all about writing songs about what you've experienced and what you believe and essentially being people taking it as a joke?
Yep, I'm worried about it. And but I write them for myself, and my intentions are to write vague enough that they don't understand them. Loving Eyes is a Buddhist song,
and
people took that seriously, and I'm not going to write any differently than that about the occult. And people will probably be able to apply lyrics that are about some of the subject matter that we've been discussing to their relationships. So the idea is, you know, I'm not going to sit there and do a record about how to conduct the a goetic ceremony here. You know what I mean? That's not going to be the. I'm not going to write about the Goetia literally. And you know, I'm standing in a 9-foot circle surrounded by the four elements of the universe. You know, I'm not going to do that. All right, but I am going to write about, all of the things that I'm studying correspond to everything. You know, the elements, the directionals, the numbers, the letters, the alphabet, the earth, you know, the sky, the God, us, our arms, our legs, our fingers. So these things are very vague, man, but they tie into a greater thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I can write about these. It's Joan Crawford said in 1946 production of Humoresque, it's a woman's privilege to be vague. I will be vague. You know, the uninitiated will not understand the nature of the lyrics. Even Danzig lyrics himself, some of them are very more or less literal and kind of can be taken as a joke. But he's a very well-researched occultist.
Mm-hmm.
And his lyrics and themes, although often frequently written from a more or less Christian standpoint or mocking of a Christian standpoint, made to evoke fear in the ears of the Christian conditioned listener. Okay, although they are written from that sort of a thesis, okay, they are still well researched and well documentable within occult and biblical text, nonetheless.
I've never heard a better summary of the approach of heavy metal to scaring the shit out of people, out of certain people.
Thanks. I'm a big fan, man. I love Danzig, man. I want to meet him so bad. You don't know, man. You know, I love him, man. I was just a little kid, but you know, I've always been a Buddhist. I've always been a Buddhist, and I just finally gave that up because I realized it was a bunch of bullshit, man. And there's wonderful, wonderful things about it. And as there is about every religion, especially Christianity. And I'm a huge fan of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big fan of Jesus. And I love what he said, and I quote him all the time. I think I quoted him once already.
Yes, you did.
I paraphrase, I should say. But, you know, I'm a fan of it all, man. I'm a fan of it all. And that's it. I don't have anything against any religion. I just see some as counterproductive to our true spiritual development.
Mm-hmm.
And as more or less, if I were to subscribe to any religious philosophy, it would be that of Thelema, which is a religion that spawned out of the teachings of Aleister Crowley. And that religion in and of itself requires the devotion of oneself to no religion. And that's part of why it works. and it is absolutely necessary as a Thelemite. Okay, for lack of a better term, that is the term. But for somebody who practices Thelema, they're called a Thelemite. But the practice of Thelema, in and of itself, is the research of all religions. And it's about being quick to see where people are right, not where they're wrong. That's what you take from it.
This is probably going to sound like a strange question. Are you familiar with James Ellroy?
No.
He's a crime writer. And I was just curious because he talks about himself in very extreme terms, and it talks about his history very frankly, and I'll just be blunt and say I kind of think a lot of what he says is he seems to me a consummate bullshit artist, but I have no doubt that he thinks he's being sincere, and I'm just curious, you know. There's an aspect, certainly in rock music, a long history of mythologizing and self-mythologizing, and, you know, is what you've been telling me verifiable and true? Or are you telling me a story?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm telling you this. Absolutely. I'm not trying to sensationalize myself, okay? I'm actually, like I said, this is the first interview I've ever done like this. And the reason is, it's the first time anybody's asked me point blank, tell me about demonic possession. You know what I mean? I throw that out there, they leave it alone.
I think that's because most people would sort of assume you're equating, you're using demonic possession as a metaphor for a drug addiction. That would be my guess. That's why I asked you about it, because
Listen to the lyrics. I mean, why would they say that after listening to the lyrics? The lyrics are very literal.